If you're running a business in Canada right now, you're playing a game where the rules keep changing. Trade tensions, economic uncertainty, shifting policies. It's clear that what happens in America doesn't always stay in America. What's happening right now is reshaping industries, disrupting supply chains, and forcing Canadian companies, whether they operate cross-border or not, to adapt faster than ever. That's why our show is evolving. Welcome to Mission Critical, the podcast where we break down the blueprints, the bold moves, and the battle-tested playbooks of today's most impactful leaders. From CEOs and founders to artists, designers, and athletes, we're talking to the visionaries who build, innovate, and lead. Because behind every great company, every groundbreaking idea, and every game-changing innovation, there's a leader on a mission. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. A few years ago, diversity, equity, and inclusion were at the top of every corporate agenda. CEOs made bold commitments, DEI roles were created overnight, and companies swore that they were ready to change. But now, the tide seems to have turned. Since the Trump administration took office in January 2025, we've seen the headlines of DEI budgets slashed, entire diversity teams eliminated, and executives suddenly going silent. Critics say that these programs are nothing more than corporate virtue signaling. Nice on paper, but never built to last. And yet, here's the paradox. The data proves that diverse companies outperform their competitors. Organizations that prioritize DEI have higher engagement, lower turnover, and even stronger financial returns, with top quartile diversity companies up to 39% more likely to outperform their competitors. So if investing in DEI is a business advantage, why are so many companies running in the opposite direction? Is this just a case of corporate leaders bowing to political pressure? Were these DEI efforts doomed from the start? Or are we simply seeing a shakeout, separating real commitment from performative action? That's where my guest today comes in. Lauren McGee is the founder and CEO of Diversio, a company using AI-driven insights to take the guesswork out of inclusion. With clients across North America and Europe, she's working at the intersection of data and diversity, proving that inclusion isn't just a moral cause, but a business imperative. Today, we're diving into the big questions. What's really driving the backlash against DEI? And how do attitudes towards diversity differ across Canada, the US, and Europe? And what actually works when it comes to building inclusive companies? In an era of growing backlash and corporate retreat, what's next for DEI? And more importantly, who's still willing to fight for it? Let's get into it. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. I am so excited to be chatting with you today because we were just talking, you know, off camera, I guess, but like how we met at the Toronto Region Board of Trade Gala, and I didn't really get a chance to really talk to you, but I was looking into your story, and like I think what you do is so incredible. So I'm really excited to talk to you about so many different things today because I feel like a company like yours is so important in this cultural, geopolitical chaos that we're living in right now. So thanks for taking the time to chat.
Delighted to.
So why don't we just start off, if you can just maybe just introduce yourself, what you do, and a quick elevator pitch on your company, just as for context.
My name is Laura McGee. I'm the founder and CEO of Diversio. And what we do is use data and analytics to help companies be more productive by creating better workplaces for their employees. So the product has two components. We have software that uses AI to measure employee experience, help you figure out, are there any barriers, any bias holding certain people back? And then more recently, we have an arm to the business that does solutions. So learning and development, training, upskilling, helping employees to do their best work.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So when it comes to the dialogue around DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, what do you think is, just to kind of kick off our conversation, an unpopular opinion about that conversation that you think holds true?
I don't think there are any popular opinions about
yeah.
it's so divided at this
yes.
point. I think the biggest thing right now, DEI has been used as a sword. It's been used absolutely as a political hot potato. When at the end of the day, the people doing this work, all they're trying to do is level the playing field, remove barriers, and help all people be more productive, more engaged, more motivated. And it's being used as a way to divide rather than unite. And that, I think, is really where the trouble begins.
Mm-hmm. You know, DEI programs have really come under a lot of attack recently, and we've seen that especially since the start of this year. We've seen it in, you know, a lot of news that companies are rolling back their commitments. A lot of executives are going kind of silent on the matter, or, you know, going and regressing in a lot of the conversation around that. And a lot of critics of DEI programs are really calling it, you know, nothing more than corporate virtue signaling. From your perspective, what are you seeing as a response to all the noise out there that's happening right now?
Look, what happened in 2020 was completely unprecedented. And when it comes to activism and progress, what happened, you know, with Black Lives Matter and the protest movement ensuing after that was a huge leap forward, but it was not perfect. And DEI became a catch-all phrase that covered everything from workplace initiatives to, you know, minimize or mitigate harassment to, you know, sponsoring and elevating people of color and different diverse groups to, exactly as you say, virtue signaling and whitewashing and pinkwashing. And I think what's happened is, you know, as occurs with many protest movements, is we got too carried away in some regards, and there was a backlash. So right now, I think we're seeing the extreme version of that backlash happen, where you know, some of the maybe less productive, frankly, less effective components of that movement have been seized upon and criticized, and now that's tainting the rest of the movement. So I think we're seeing a lot of, absolutely, as I said previously, politicization of DEI as a concept. And, you know, now it's a moment where leaders are either coming out as champions of what they see as business realities, and others are nervous and they're backing away.
Yeah, yeah. That is true that you've seen, it's kind of people, or at least what we are seeing in the media is that, like, a lot of corporations are choosing left or right, and it's like they're either doubling down on their commitments or have, like, completely seemingly abandoned a lot of the commitments and are just going in a completely different direction. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of, like, wishy-washy. It's like yes or no, and it, but maybe that's not the case. I don't know.
It's funny. I would disagree.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that actually the truth is in the middle.
Yeah.
And so, for example, I mean, everybody's seen the media, and it seems like every other day there's a major brand that has, you know, completely canceled DEI at their company. That's what the headline says.
Yeah.
We looked into it. So we've been tracking major brands that have been covered in the media. There's been about 30 and change companies that have been covered. And what we discovered is that there's been about six that have truly walked back. Mm-hmm. So think John Deere, think Tractor Supply Company. And they truly have, from everything that we can tell, canceled DEI in all of its forms that we can discern. The companies that have gotten, I think, even more press, so think Meta, think Amazon, a lot of the big tech companies, they have not canceled DEI. They've rebranded it. They've refocused. And so if you, like we have, really look at the press release, look at the corporate communication, look at the emails to employees, it's, you know, we're moving away from DEI, but inclusion and belonging are still critical to the business. And we're not canceling our mentorship programs, and we're not canceling our ERGs, and absolutely we'll continue to make sure everybody feels supported.
Right.
And so you look at the headline, it doesn't really match up for those of us in the space with what's happening at the company. And that's what we said earlier is, you know, this entire thing is designed to have a chilling effect. And when you read, all you read is a headline and you don't do the homework, which, I mean, it's our job, so of course we do it.
Mm-hmm.
The message that you receive as a leader is all of my peers are walking this back. Should I be doing the same thing?
Yeah, yeah, interesting. You founded Diversio also at a time when a lot of companies were just starting to take DEI seriously and really consider it. What was the biggest roadblock you faced when you were trying to convince organizations that diversity and inclusion should be something that's measured like any other business metric, that it wasn't just some soft quality, qualitative thing, that you could actually have quantifiable kind of metrics around it?
Right. I would have given you a different answer 3 years ago. I think it's with the wisdom of time. So I would have said previously it was convincing them that there was a business case and that really investing in creating an inclusive workplace will result in more revenue, lower costs, lower attrition. What I've come to believe, and I think it's because there just are so many different studies and academic papers for a million reasons explaining why DEI is good for business, I really do think it's human bias. I think it's people get, you know, they're fearful of change often. and people want to hold on to power even if they don't realize it. Mm-hmm. And so I think some of the biggest things are, you know, inherently, and we're seeing this come out right now, people worry that, you know, they'll lose their job. If there's a DEI initiative, they won't get a fair shot. Mm-hmm. Or if they don't fit a certain category, that means that they're excluded from advancement. And there's a lot of, I think, peer pressure around what's okay to say, what's not okay to say, that influences the conversation. So you can have all of the data, but for us, it comes down to, you have to appeal to common sense and values and explain to people, again, we reiterate over and over, it's not about giving anyone an unfair advantage, it's about removing barriers.
Right, right. Leveling the playing field.
Level the playing field, exactly.
So it's not that things are being taken away, it's just that doors are being opened for others that have historically not had those opportunities.
Exactly. It's make sure the door is open and everybody can walk through.
Yeah. What do you think, I mean, I guess building on that, what do you think are kind of some of the biggest misconceptions or myths around DEI programs that you've come to, come across in your work and dispel through your work?
I think some people see opportunity as a pie, and that you have to slice up the pie. Mm-hmm. So different people get a different size of opportunity.
And that's the language in the conversation, like, you know, you're left crumbs, or you're left this portion of the pie while the rest, you know, like, it is very much part of the dialogue.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So I think some people feel like the past 4 or 5 years, we've been redividing the pie. And a certain type of people, white, cis, heterosexual men, are getting a smaller piece of the pie. And the way that we think about it is we're growing the pie. And like, sticking on this analogy, my favorite one is, you know, it's not just about fairness, it's we believe that if there is a diversity of perspectives, that the end result is better. Mm-hmm. And the analogy is like, if you're baking a pie, for example, if you have all of one ingredient, you're gonna have a shitty pie. If all you have is flour, you're eating flour. You need apples, you need sugar, you need baking soda. And so the way that we think about it is like, look, introduce all of those different ingredients, you have to figure out how to cook it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not gonna, you know, bake itself. But the outcome is you have something, you know, much better.
Yeah. If we're, you know, we often hear that what gets measured can be managed, right? A lot of companies seem apprehensive or terrified of what DEI data may show about their reveal about their companies. Do you think that the leaders of these companies are afraid of what they'll find, or that they'll actually have to do something about it once they do find those pieces of data?
Yeah, so I am probably overly logical. The way I see it is, if you feel like if your knee hurts, are you going to avoid the doctor? It's not going to get better. Just because you don't know it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And certainly for me, if I think that I might have cancer, you better believe I'm going to get scanned for it. So I think, yes, absolutely. And sometimes I'm nervous to go to the doctor. I don't like going to the dentist. I probably have a cavity, mm-hmm. but it's going to get worse if I don't treat it. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, we see some fear and a lot of denial about what may be going on within the company. But I mean, the light bulb moments that we see with our clients, if you look at employee engagement data, for example, and you say, you know, a standard question is, how motivated are you today? Mm-hmm. And if you cut that data by demographic and you see all of the men in the company are feeling extremely motivated, all the women are feeling demotivated, or maybe caregivers, or maybe an older demographic. Like, that's a trend that helps you identify a pain point. And human resources are still resources. If, you know, 30% of your workforce are not feeling motivated, you're losing 30% productivity.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot, you know, the benefit far outweighs the costs of looking into the data.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm also curious, you know, a lot of DEI efforts vary widely across different markets too, and the culture around the conversations we have around diversity are different, you know, in Canada versus America versus Europe and Asia. Like, you know, it's different, it's contextual. How does a corporate approach, in your experience, to diversity differ between Canada and the US and Europe, or in the markets that you are active in, and what are the fundamental differences that stand out to you?
My favorite part of my job is we work across about 35 countries, and no region or even sub-region is the same. Hmm. So how you think about concepts like inclusion and belonging, very different, but even what kinds of demographics influence inclusion, exclusion, also very different. Mm. But I would say this is one, I'm going to say, positive, hopefully, ultimately, component of this backlash or correction. I think that over the past 4 years, having open conversations has been difficult. And it felt like there was a set of rules and norms around language and what you could say that was tacitly enforced and sometimes loudly enforced. Mm-hmm. And that prevented us from having those open conversations and really helping one another learn. So I think that's a positive thing, is I do feel, even myself, that I can more productively talk about these topics right now without feeling like I have to get it 100% right.
Sure.
But yeah. Some of the differences to your question, I just mentioned I was in London last week, New York and Stockholm.
Yeah.
Like, the difference in vibes across those three cities was palpable. Mm. And so just as an example, and no country has it right. So we find, you know, you might be extremely gender inclusive in one region, like the Nordics, mm-hmm. but race is, you know, hugely behind, not mm-hmm. even talked about. Or you might be, you know, we talk a lot about Indigenous reconciliation in Canada. New Zealand does a great job of this, not even acknowledged often in the US. Mm. So there's different, nobody has it perfect. But I will say some of the differences in Sweden, this was so interesting, as we talked about earlier, I'm conditioned to really emphasize the business case. Right now, DEI as a concept is under fire. And so for us, it's okay, reiterate, persuade leaders, like if you retreat, that's going to affect your bottom line. In Sweden, they didn't want to hear about that. It was, hey, look, this is our value.
Sure.
Like, this is a value of ours. We don't, as a CEO, it's non-negotiable.
Right, right.
And so that was refreshing to be like, okay, well, different cultures are at different stages when it comes to this topic.
That is really interesting because, yeah, the value set is different across market. And as a company that operates in so many different markets, how do you approach that, I guess that kind of, how do you approach that, those differences when culturally they're so different across markets?
Yeah, I mean, I do believe everywhere people want to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Not everyone everywhere, but generally human beings want to do the right thing. So you have to meet people where they are. Mm-hmm. So when I'm in, I mean, we absolutely have clients in very red states, in very, you know, traditional sectors, think like automotive, think farming, in red states. I did a keynote in Texas recently at the Chamber of Commerce. And what I've discovered, the people want to do the right thing. They don't feel that, it's not that they want to eliminate fairness, it's that they feel that DEI, as they understand it, is not promoting fairness. And so I think you have to really get down to the nitty gritty and say, what are we talking about? Are we talking about hiring quotas, which actually, maybe I agree with you, in some cases that's not fair. Or are we talking about eliminating bias from job interviews, which most people would agree, okay, we shouldn't, you know, discriminate actively when we talk about hiring someone.
So is the biggest kind of, I guess, or one of the biggest issues in this conversation that DEI is kind of like a catch-all for a lot of different things that have very complex kind of nuances and people just don't understand how to tackle them individually or how to even approach those conversations?
I think that's one challenge. The way that someone put it to me in London, which I really liked, is she said, identity politics killed DEI. Mm-hmm. And when you think about, you know, the Trump administration, it's not DEI per se, it's wokeism. And it's this idea that certain groups should be elevated at the expense of other groups.
Yes.
And that people should be bucketed and categorized as a defining principle.
Yeah, it's become like an ideology and like identity politics too.
Right.
Around that. I mean, speaking of America, you know, there's been a sharp rise in anti-DEI sentiment, with some arguing that a lot of these initiatives create division rather than inclusion. Last year, American billionaire investor Bill Ackman stated that DEI is, quote, inherently a racist and illegal movement in its implementation, even if it purports to work on behalf of the so-called oppressed. What do you say to clients or potential clients that may share kind of like a similar belief system?
God, give me the confidence of Bill Ackman. That is such a bold statement.
Yeah.
I don't even know. You know, the idea that Bill Ackman is speaking for every DEI program at all companies all across the earth is laughable. Mm-hmm. And so I actually forget the question just thinking about that.
Well, I guess the question is, my question was, what do you say to a client that may have a similar belief system? But then also, if they're coming to you, are they even going to have that belief system, I guess?
No, absolutely. Yeah, they are. Okay. I mean, because the thing is that companies are multi-stakeholder, and so you might have a board member who's very passionate and say to the CEO, like, look, this is a priority, you got to do something, and the CEO didn't organically decide to, and then they're resistant. For us, it comes down to what are you trying to achieve? And the way that we think about it is, like, diversity helps you identify trends. Demographics helps you identify trends. It's not the solution. The solution is inclusion, because that's the culture that's going to create performance. So for us, it's like, look at the data, look at experience, look at advancement, look at attrition through a demographic lens to help you understand, are there any patterns? So women are less engaged, LGBT employees are less engaged, people of color are not being promoted. That tells you that there's a problem in your pipeline, and that's inefficient.
Yeah.
That's a leaky pipeline. You're losing investment in people and training and onboarding. The solution, though, should be programs that actually are, I think, typically not demographically tied.
Right.
So it's, if you want to eliminate harassment, because that's why women are leaving, it's not eliminate harassment for women. It's eliminate harassment.
Right. And if we just roll it back a little bit, what are the fundamental differences between diversity, equity, and inclusion if we are just talking about how that's being defined?
Yeah, I love this expression. So diversity is being invited to the party.
Yeah.
Inclusion is being asked to dance.
Right.
The equity component means different things to different people. Typically, it's equal opportunity. Some people think of it as equal outcome. I think that's where there are ideological differences. But diversity is like, who is in your company? What are their, you know, different experiences, different backgrounds? Inclusion is what's their experience at the company?
I like that. And how are you being engaged, I guess, to access opportunities or just be at the table?
Yep, supported, developed, mentored, exactly.
Have you ever, in your experience, had a moment where you saw a company kind of completely fail their DEI efforts despite their public commitments? And what did you notice went wrong in those kinds of instances?
We saw a lot of that in 2022.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we found the interesting thing about right now is we probably have a more engaged and successful client base now than we did at the height of Black Lives Matter, because the companies that are, you know, continuing with their DEI programs in a, you know, maybe a recession, during maybe a trade war, they've created a business case. It matters for their values, it matters for their people, for their planning. And so where, to your question, have I seen anyone fail? Yes, plenty of times. And it's typically because it was reactive. You know, there was a big moment, they got pressure from their employees or their customers to do something, they picked something pretty random. Typically, we've seen these decisions get made. If somebody has a pet project or a pet idea, there's no strategic case around it. And so therefore, it's not really communicated, why are we doing this?
Right.
And then the second the wind changes, it gets abandoned. And that was a waste of time and a waste of effort.
So kind of lip service around a cultural shift and just trying to keep up with the momentum of that.
Lip service, yes, but it can even be a well-intended program that's not really, it wasn't really implemented because of data. It was somebody heard, my favorite example, we had one client, I won't name them early on, who came to us and said, you know, we think that it was post-Me Too, we think we have a big harassment problem. And so we think that we want to support our women, we don't want to be caught there, so we're about to spend $1 million on a harassment program, but first we want to run a quick survey. And so we ran the survey, and we have a scorecard that shows you on the y-axis different metrics of inclusion. So, you know, harassment, culture, mentorship. And then on the y-axis, we have different demographics. So typically we have like gender, race, ethnicity, LGBTQ, disability, mental health. And the women row was green.
Okay.
Women felt great. There was very little harassment. They were above benchmark on every metric. The LGBTQ line, all red. And so what they discovered was, shit, we actually, we're about to spend $1 million on an anti-harassment program. That's not our problem.
Right.
And meanwhile, we have, they had 20% of their staff identified as LGBT. They felt excluded on every metric. And so that's, you know, they're disengaged, they're unproductive. That would have been a waste of resources. So I think we saw a lot of, you know, implement whatever is in vogue.
Yeah.
It's not solving a problem. and ultimately not effective.
So did that company shift its strategy to kind of focus on the actual demographic that was showing red?
They did indeed.
Okay.
Hard pivot. And yeah. It's one of my favorite stories because this was before we did a lot of the solutioning. Mm-hmm. We, of course, gave them advice and they went rogue. And I remember they told us their plan and my co-founder and I were like, don't do that.
Oh, God.
And so what they did ultimately was their entire executive team, it was for Pride Month, uh-huh. decided to dress in drag and okay. go to a town hall and, you know, and we were like, this is going to go so wrong. You guys don't, you know, and it was a smash. And we got feedback at the next survey. I've never felt so included at this company. I've never felt comfortable being out. I never felt really supported. And I mean, it was an authentic thing that the executives saw the data. They were shocked and appalled. They wanted to do something drastic to indicate and signal that they were, they wanted a change, exactly.
Yes, yes. That's so interesting. That's a great story. So Diversio is driven by artificial intelligence and using, you know, to collect the data and everything. What makes that platform different from kind of traditional DEI consulting or training programs?
Yeah, I mean, we use AI in a few different ways. We used AI before LLMs. We're helping everybody, so we trained our own algorithm. And so initially, one of the problems with collecting data across employees is you're kind of looking for a needle in the haystack. So you ask an employee engagement questionnaire with 60 questions. You're kind of hoping you're asking mm-hmm. the right one to get you the insight. And secondly is people don't always feel comfortable talking about their experience. And so what we did is we said, okay, let's be an objective, secure third party firewalled to collect candid data from employees through free text. Mm. So don't ask 60 questions, ask one open-ended question, tell me about your experience, mm-hmm. analyze that using AI, and then play back the results, again, anonymized to the company. What we discovered though is that if you use typical algorithms, there's bias baked into them.
Yeah.
So very specifically, the way that somebody who was raised in India talks about harassment is different than the way somebody raised in Canada talks about harassment. And people are, when they explain their experience, they're not saying, I was harassed by my boss.
Yes.
They tell you what happened.
Yeah.
And so we found we had to engage a very diverse group of people to train the algorithm, to label the data and catch those nuances.
Right, right.
So that was a learning experience for me using AI. And then what we did is we connected that data collection process to this basically data set of solutions. And we started to connect problems with answers and then track our company's experiences over now 7 years to identify problem X is solved by solution A, not by solution B, and we can track it over time.
Yeah, 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 I love that. We talked about kind of some regional differences between different like markets and countries when it comes to understanding the conversation around diversity. You know, Canada often prides itself on being more progressive in the conversation around DEI than the US. Is that something that is actually true? And where do you think Canada falls short compared to other countries?
I'm going to start with a positive note. Mm-hmm. I'm half American. I disclosed that earlier.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that coming under threat, listen, I also did American studies as an undergrad. Canadians, we define ourselves, like it or not, in contrast to the US in many ways. And I think this moment of feeling under threat by the US has forced us to sit back and say, what do we stand for? What are our values? Mm-hmm. And I do believe that Canadians value inclusion. I do believe that we believe that what makes us different makes us stronger. And, you know, I feel that that was under threat last year.
Yeah.
I felt that there was a movement that was antagonistic towards those values that was starting to take hold. And I think that we have been confronted with the outcome of letting that movement take hold. Mm. And I don't think we want to be, you know, I don't think we want to look like the US administration. I really don't.
Yeah. It's also such an interesting intersection that you personally are at because you are half American, half Canadian. And so how do you reconcile and navigate these conversations that are really between Canada and the US and our values and the possibility of us becoming the 51st? Like, how do you personally navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, this came up a lot in Europe. companies right now, like people, are trying to figure out how do we engage with the United States. And what I try to reflect back, and I'm probably an example of this, Americans are not Donald Trump.
Yeah.
American companies are not Donald Trump. And so an interesting anecdote that came up at the London event that I hosted was one of the women there was doing business development and said, you know, I've been looking at the websites of all of my U.S. clients to figure out have they taken down their DEI pages. And she couldn't find a single one that had taken down their DEI page. And that was surprising to her. And my reaction was, I'm an American. I run actually a U.S. headquartered company. Of course, I'm a diversity company, but I wouldn't have taken down. The values that Americans hold are typically actually not divisive. They're not inflammatory. They're not exclusionary. They can be. But it is a tension internally that I feel is, you know, I have a U.S. passport. I voted in the U.S. election. I'm now represented by someone that I don't align with at all. And I think you have to really understand the American people to say, you know, absolutely, America was not working for everybody, and the vote was for change, and the vote was for an economy that's more accessible, and housing prices to come down, and, you know, what felt like a common sense approach to borders. And, you know, unfortunately, we got someone who has gone in a bunch of directions that have taken a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, yeah. But I do like that kind of reminder that it is a very vocal minority of people that are very, very loud and visible that are kind of painting with a broad stroke brush of what of this kind of like culture war that we're in right now too, but it's not representative of the majority of the people that are, you know, within the States too, and also here too. Like, we have, you know, similar problems here too.
I would also say, and I shouldn't be political, but here I am. Look, a lot of these tactics are designed to manipulate people. And like I said, like the address that Trump made at the World Economic Forum, where, you know, he proclaimed that DEI was dead, that he's going to root out companies that have these programs in place, which are completely legal, and where, you know, his executive order was just shut down by a federal court for being unconstitutional. Like, that is designed to chill behavior.
Yeah.
That's what it's, you know, it's not, and I am a lawyer, and I've, you know, analyzed the statements and the orders. Like, I agree with the federal court that said they're unconstitutional. So I think it's worth remembering, like, these are politicians. Yeah. This is a politician who's trying to preserve power.
Yeah, stoke the fire a little bit too, right? When you're working with a company that is perhaps a little resistant to change, what's your first move? And, you know, do you focus more on the data? Is it the storytelling, values, or something else? What's kind of like the first step that you take to with a company that's a little harder to budge?
Yeah, so that's something else I got wrong. So initially we thought, let the data speak for itself.
Yeah.
Run the survey, produce the scorecard, show them how they benchmark. And if people see, you know, these are data-driven executives, if they see the numbers, they'll take action. Again, this is an area that is not the price of widgets. This is human bias and confronting, you know, long-held assumptions. So typically, you meet them where they are. Often, we'll hold a session with the executive team, have a very candid, safe space discussion, which means safe to say all the things that are not politically correct without judgment, get it out there, and then figure out where do we align from a values perspective. And that's typically where we'll surface. Resistance typically, again, comes down to that pie analogy, where the feeling is that we're just redividing and slicing out opportunity. And so we have to get to a place where we're all in it for the same thing, which is we work for this company. Everybody wants it to succeed. What's the best way to do that, given that people are usually our most valuable resource?
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. In our conversation, you've kind of hinted at it a few times, but have you ever had to kind of challenge your own assumptions around DEI and also like what works and what doesn't work?
Always.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I've gone more than 6 or 9 months. Like I just said, I think three times in this podcast already, like I got it wrong.
Right.
Like I will say I have come around, there are even programs and policies that I've seen not work and do more harm than good. One that I've gone back and forth on specifically are quotas. Because, you know, initially I thought I don't believe in them, because to me that feels like my theory is we want to remove barriers, not engineer outcomes. And yeah. I thought quotas are more engineering of outcomes. Then I pivoted because I saw companies do everything they could to remove barriers and you're still not getting equal outcomes. Mm. And so my thought was, okay, maybe we have to be more drastic. Angela Merkel actually had a similar sort of, she says it much more eloquent than I. And then now I've come back to, okay, you know what? I think this has stoked a lot of the outrage that has resulted in the backlash. Mm. So maybe that is a step too far. So I think it's all about looking at interventions, there is context specific.
Yeah.
And then being willing to say, okay, look, maybe this didn't work as well as we hoped.
And so checks and balances, just checking in and seeing how things are going.
This is a space that needs innovation.
Yeah.
Like if it was an easy answer, we wouldn't take 100 years to close the gender gap.
Yeah.
So.
It's true. Yeah. What do you think is one measurable kind of business outcome, whether it's revenue, retention, productivity, that companies really overlook when they are investing in DEI programs?
I think the two biggest ones are retention and engagement. Mm-hmm. So it's expensive to replace people, and mm-hmm. you can't typically pick, and often it's your best performers that will leave. Mm-hmm. And then engagement is a proxy often for productivity. So it's like you can get someone to come to work, but are they going to work well while they're there?
Yeah. And just because we are in this kind of hyper-focused, you know, conversation around DEI, if you could kind of sit down with the biggest critics of corporate DEI efforts, what's like the one piece of evidence or argument that you believe would help change their minds and help them understand the context from which you're approaching these conversations?
I think that'd be fool's errand. The first thing that I would say to them is, when you say DEI, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. Very specifically, what programs, what policies, what interventions do you mean?
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to defend DEI as a concept. That's way too ambiguous. And I think that's where we're going wrong, is we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater for sure.
Right. So how do you think that... If you could call it something else other than DEI, mm-hmm. and help people understand like all the kind of nuance and complexities within it, what's the language that you use to approach and talk about it?
This is really simple and basic, but I often, if I really encounter someone very resistant and very adamant about no more DEI, I usually will say to them, most people consider anti-harassment efforts DEI. Mm-hmm. So give me an example where you think harassment is good for your business.
Right.
In what way is eliminating harassment bad for your business?
A reframe of perspective.
And that's like the quintessential DEI program.
Right.
So it's like if we're going to completely eliminate DEI, anti-harassment's going to go with it. Harassment is likely going to go up.
Yeah.
And explain to me, just as a human being, why you think that will get better results from your people.
Yeah. We've talked about your business journey a little bit too and just how you've kind of evolved, but what do you think have been some of the biggest wins for you just as a founder and just building up your company in a time where it is such a big part of the cultural discussion?
Listen, the fact that we're still here, I take almost as a bit of a win. I mean, my favorite is looking at the outcomes of the companies. The one thing that I love about the fact that we're a data company is that we can measure results.
Yeah.
And so we track all 450 of our clients, and we see, you know, a 7-point improvement on average across all those companies. Very few companies do not improve. Mm. So that outcome, and we collect the free text, hearing somebody say, for example, I have never felt comfortable being out at my company until now. Like, you can't put a price on that. So I think the best outcomes are, you know, you give people the tools. Often DEI teams, like, they're under-resourced, they don't have a budget, they don't have influence. When they have data, data's power. So giving them that and seeing them use that as justification to implement a program, get it paid for, get the CEO to personally announce it and be invested in the outcome, like, that's impact. So that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. You mentioned the client that had the kind of queer community internally that did not rank well in terms of the survey that they did. Are there any other stories that kind of hold a special place in your heart in terms of the clients that you have worked with and you would consider a win or a big learning lesson?
Yeah, one of my favorites, and their head of DEI just spoke at our company town hall, and we're in Canada, so I'll speak about Canadian Blood Services, mm-hmm. which is the organization that facilitates blood donations. Yeah. So, you know, could not be more essential to Canadians. Yeah. And so they've been with us for quite a while, and what they've decided to do as a strategy is not just create a more inclusive and diverse staff internally, but also the kind of rationale there is that they need more diverse donors. Mm-hmm. Because we need, as Canadians, we need blood to serve all communities because mm-hmm. accidents don't discriminate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they've seen a direct correlation between, okay, we have a more inclusive environment that's attractive to all kinds of people from all walks of life in Canada. And then those people become community ambassadors. They go back home to their apartment or their homes, wherever it is. Mm-hmm. They encourage people to give blood, and they've seen more diverse people donating. So that, and that's saving lives.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really cool
And that has a measurable example. Result there.
Measurable, and there could
and
be
lives.
Anything more important.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Last question. If someone were to follow your blueprint or game plan for success and the things that you've achieved, not just in terms of impact, but also just building a company in general, which is hard in and of itself, what is kind of like the one non-negotiable rule that you would tell them to follow?
Be scrappy and partner. Especially, and I felt this, so women raise something like less than 2% of venture capital. Mm-hmm. People do not give women money. Particularly mm-hmm. if they're not engineers. I'm not an engineer, neither was my co-founder. So there was no chance we were going to raise when we started. We raised our Series A from one of the best San Francisco VCs after we had, you know, over $1 million in recurring revenue, margins of 85%, NPS score off the charts. We needed everything in place for people to believe that we were backable. And so the way that we got there was we had to figure out win-win partnerships that didn't involve us paying people. And so we worked with universities to develop our technology. We gave them back, paid them back in data. We worked with interns, gave them fantastic work experience, kind of paid them whatever we could. Mm-hmm. You know, we partnered with industry associations to serve their members very efficiently at scale, and then, you know, generated some revenue that way. So, and the outcome has been, again, we're still here, and I kind of joked about that, is we have that baked into us. That scrappiness, that resourcefulness is something that has served us immeasurably through these crazy market lectures.
Because, I mean, if you just look at the last 5-6 years, the world's gone through a lot, and you have to be able to pivot and be able to be scrappy and resilient in order to kind of weather a lot of the things that we've had to weather.
Totally, especially in tech. I mean, how many companies failed in 2022 when the funding dried up?
Yeah.
Because they didn't know how to operate on a lean budget. And I think as women who couldn't raise capital, we had to learn that.
The resilience. Yeah. I love that. Thank you so much for the chat, Laura. I really appreciated it. I was so looking forward to our chat because just everything that's going on, and I think people are just like don't know what to make of it. And I think having an understanding of the way that you approach your sector and your work and the way that you work with a lot of the leading companies is really powerful and insightful. So thank you so much for the chat.
I will say just one thing. I think what you're doing and what your audience believes, I hope you feel empowered. Because I think it's a moment where a lot of us feel disempowered. Mm-hmm. And I think that's psychological. So I love what you're doing, and it's really been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
That's a wrap on this episode of Mission Critical. If today's conversation gave you something to think about, do me a favor. Subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Big ideas are meant to be shared, and the best insights only matter if they're put into action. Until next time, stay sharp, stay curious, and go make something happen. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical.